The first one someone asked was, how long is the process of doing research on an author or a book, doing the episode and launching? So the how long is the full process, basically? This is dependent on the episode, on the thinker, whether or not I'm already familiar with the thinker, whether or not I'm already familiar with the guest. I would say that if I stick to it and get to it fairly quickly and I'm not having problems reading the content, and the turnaround time is about 2 weeks, or maybe 2 to 3 weeks. So clarify that the guest is up for doing it, then read the book, which is hopefully fairly average length. Of course, if it's longer, that takes a lot longer time. And then, you know, take the notes, get them back over to them, and then schedule. So yeah, it's about normally two to four weeks full turnaround time. Obviously, it's longer with certain guests, certain people who've got busy schedules, and longer for... I do try like to at least understand the topic, so it that can take a while if I don't know the topic too well. About 2 to 4 weeks. The next question was, do you have a recommendation of the best book for understanding the Hermetic tarot symbolism? There's a lot of good books. So Christian Meditations on the Tarot is like my go-to. Obviously, that's what I did the full series on. That's like my go-to tarot book. I think it really helps give an understanding of what the tarot is without even going into divination. And then if you want to actually use them, then you can. Written obviously by Valentin Tonberg, with a foreword by Hans von Balthasar. That's fairly good, but I would also recommend Uspensky's book on the tarot as a fairly good starting place. There's also, I'm going to completely blank his name, a very, very small, quite literally a small book on the tarot that used to be packaged with the Rider-Waite tarot sets. That's also a good intro to tarot. That's pretty much all I'd say about tarot. I haven't read too widely outside of those. Someone asks my dream guest list. Living people who maybe haven't been available, reachable, or the timing hasn't been right, but you'd love to have them on. My absolute dream guest, who was never going to happen, and he was alive while I was doing this, was Cormac McCarthy, of course. But he's sort of a dream guest in the sense that I wouldn't have really had much to say to him at all. Maybe I would have preferred to just have a pint with Cormac McCarthy rather than talk about books or anything like that. But he would have been my dream guest. And then also, like, without seeming too edgy, I genuinely would have loved to interview Ted Kaczynski before he died, to get some interview relating to his actual work as opposed to the biographical stuff. Other dream guests, there's a lot of spiritual guests that I would like to have on. I mean, I'd like to have a few of the previous guests that I've had on again, who were sort of tougher to schedule. Zizek is sort of a dream guest, though. I even do have his email, but he hasn't replied to me yet. It would just be a very fun conversation, and one I'd like to have before he's no longer with us. I think he's getting on a bit now, but no meanness intended there to Zizek. But he would be a dream guest. There isn't too many others. I think anyone who I feel I could contact and get on, I would straight away. Usually you're just not going to get a reply from people like that who are super, super busy. Someone said, have you ever narrated an audiobook before? If you want to, could, what book would you choose? And they said that some of their favourites were me doing the book reviews. If I could do an audiobook of anything, it'd probably be Moby Dick, because when I read and when I go back and read bits of Moby Dick, it is something that I love to read out loud, especially the sort of monologues from Ahab. And when I was reading it out for the book review, I greatly enjoyed that. So I'd love to read. If I could do an audiobook of anything, it would be Moby Dick. Whether or not my accent would really work for the book I don't know. I don't know what my accent would work for in audiobook form. I'm trying to think if there's any others. Maybe any of the sort of the basic westerns, like the Virginian or Riders of the Purple Sage, like a sort of fairly fun western would be fun to anything epic as well. I think that's, yeah, Moby Dick would be top of my list for audiobook. And someone asked a question which quite a lot of people have been asking me, which might take a little bit of time to explain, and I have to tread carefully in a way. Someone asked me for an update on my spiritual journey and on Be Not Afraid. So at some point, likely later this year, I have a book coming out with Aeon Books called A Call to God, A Journey, An Introduction to Spiritual Christianity. Sorry, A Spiritual Introduction to Christianity. So it's a fairly short book with Aeon, with a focus on the actual spiritual practice of what it is to be a Christian. And one of the things I tried to do with this book when it comes out, and obviously when I was writing it, is from all my time in other spiritual alternative paths, one thing that you find as a way to give people that broad foundation when they begin, and something that I found, to be honest, did find lacking. You'd find this in alternative spiritual paths is something like a guidebook of a 10, 20 week guide, or maybe even a year is a classic one, and then you'd get onto year two and year three. And of course, you know, this is a difficult thing to do for any religion, but for Christianity or many other religions, you feel like if you're saying, right, do this on week one, do this on week two, do this on week three, it comes across as if you're saying these are the only things you can do, and that's not what I wanted to put across. But one thing I wanted to emphasize with it that I found lacking was, like, coming from a background where you really, the focus of the spiritual path is the actual spiritual practice, I found it a bit lacking to suddenly be more involved with things like dogma and, you know, say, religious life and readings and things like that. My focus has always been more of the actual practice and what you might call connection with something greater. So that book's coming out in terms of where I veered with Christianity. In terms of Catholicism, I get pulled forward and backwards all the time, but one thing that I want to, I guess, reiterate in a way, this is sort of not necessarily a regret. I wouldn't define it as a regret to have made it a public thing, but more so that I should have been far more patient with my journey and far more sort of perhaps even subtle about it, and just allowed it time to breathe, as opposed to like jumping in with both feet and declaring things left, right and center. So, you know, that's one thing of being someone who is an online figure of sorts, I guess, is that to tie my personal life, you know, my personal life in that sense was somewhat tied up with the podcast, because I do all the spiritual stuff on the podcast and spiritual talks and things like that. So it was difficult to avoid it if I was going to be mentioning it. But I think that's my advice as well, is just to take your time, because that's why I didn't really do it. It was like, right, I'm all in, everything's going to be this. And then, you know, it's a bumpy ride and you've got to give it time. And there's one thing as well that I emphasize in the book, the first of the two books. So the second book's going to be the Esoteric Christianity book, focusing on different esoteric Christian figures throughout history, written with Aaron French, from the course that we did, but far longer and in book format. And the first book is, I mean, it really does emphasize that things aren't that easy. They're fairly up and down and bumpy all the time. So, you know, that's pretty much where my... And also, I'm not as reluctant now to draw other things in that I enjoy, that I really got something from before. So now my, you know, very, very roughly, my spiritual practice is something akin to like maybe Christianity mixed with Gurdjieff or something like that. But, you know, I have more days than not where it's extremely dark, dry, if not nothing at all. And I find myself reading someone like Spengler and trying to understand my place in the world as someone who has been born within this temporal context. And that's the difficulty, I think, at the moment, in terms of a lot of people have asked me about my spiritual journey. And it's coming to terms with, at some point, feeling the need for a spirituality, feeling the need for that extra thing. And then also finding a balance between that and the fact, which it is a fact, that I am and we are, people alive today, are modern human beings, even if we don't particularly identify with the pastimes of modernity. We are modern beings with a historical mindset, with a quantified mindset. We aren't in an age of faith anymore. We have these like relics of faith that we can look at and reach to, but other than that, it's that difficult transition period between the two eras that is very tough to sort of come to terms with, especially consistently. Someone asks in the chat, happy birthday, thank you. Are there any topics or hobbies you've had an interest in doing a podcast on, but it's too far outside of the normal scope? There's been a lot, actually, because since I've picked up this as a skill and I can sort of do it fairly smoothly now, there's a lot of things I think, that would be fun to create something around. But I also know how much effort it is, and I also know that as much as I still love philosophy and love spirituality and love all the things I talk about, it's taken a tiny amount of the... You do, at least to a certain degree, have to be a bit more bureaucratic about it and read things in a certain way and talk about things in a certain way. So it's not necessarily that it kills the love or smothers the enjoyment, but it's akin to if someone who was teaching philosophy, for instance, they're now going to have a different relationship to philosophy that they did when they were just a student or just reading it for enjoyment. So, the main one, and I don't even mean this as a joke, the main one that I would like to do is like a history of snooker podcast or something along those lines, because I adore snooker more than a lot of things, and just be able to talk about snooker and maybe wangle my way into becoming a snooker commentator would be good. Other than that, I think there's now conversations. So earlier on in the days of the podcast, I would talk to guests that were a little less known, perhaps a little more radical, a little more crazy, and I miss those kind of conversations in a way, and it's tough now to gauge where the line is with them. So maybe a podcast like a tangential podcast that has more of those radical, crazy conversations with theories that aren't as necessarily academically rigorous or whatever it might be, that would be more fun. I always, at one point, I did play around with the idea of like a theory fiction podcast, which was set in the past, like a radio show from the past that's fragmented in time and sort of a fictional, serialized podcast along those lines. But it takes a lot to get enough people to sort of together to organize these things. So that was those are ideas that I had. Outside of that, what other hobbies do I have? I mean, maybe like, I do the book reviews now, maybe more a more fiction novel focused one, but I think that's finding its way into hermetics pretty naturally, so that's fine. If anyone else has got any other questions, please let me know in the chat. Those were all the ones from, there wasn't too many in the Q&A response before Christmas. So there was only those five before Christmas. So if anyone has any other questions they'd like to ask. But while I wait for if there's any other questions, I'm just trying to think what's coming up. So we've got the chat on nihilism is coming up. Another chat with Jason Horsley, which we recorded today, which was very good, is going to be live at some point in the next month. There is... let me get my calendar. There is a chat on alchemy that I'm recording next week with Brian Cotnoir, I believe his name is pronounced, which I'm excited about. His books on alchemy seem to be the go-to books on alchemy these days, and really accessible and really fun to read, and also has that practical element which moves away from the current sort of psychological, psycho-spiritual climate of understanding alchemy, actually more so as a spiritual thing, as a psychological alchemy, internal refining alchemy, and it has that practical emphasis of quite literally alchemy. So I'm excited for that. And then also next week, chatting to Jay Garfield again about his book, his latest book about the self. So the fact we don't have a self and the difference between self and person. And Jay was really fun to talk to last time, so I'm looking forward to that. And then speaking to Aaron French again about Jacob Burma, mystical Christian, fairly overlooked, not too well known, so excited for that. And then the week after that, John Michael Greer is starting to do podcasts again. So me and Greer have two podcasts lined up. The first one's booked in. First one's on the Kabbalah. So just be talking to him about the Kabbalah. And then the second one is on the Hamitic Order of the Golden Dawn. So two things that he knows a lot about and that we could chat about and have a fun time. Outside of that, still a fair bit actually planned. I've got a little bit more reading to do on Ser, on Hermes, the recently released first volume translation of Ser's Hermes, and then a book on weird mysticism with Chiron and sort of, yeah, Chiron and weird sort of pessimistic mysticism. That's by Baumgartner. And there is a few others that I've got so much on. Tim Howes, hopefully in a... Yeah, this is way off because someone was asking how much I prepare for an episode and I hadn't read any William Golding. And Tim Howes has been reading a lot of William Golding lately. Asked if I wanted to do an episode. I haven't read any. I haven't even read Lord of the Flies, which actually I'm about halfway through. Greatly enjoying it. It's a very quick read. He is a very strange, which at the moment I need to read a bit more, but at the moment I would describe it as a sort of animism, a very animistic world, very alive worlds where things are given strange characteristics. So William Golding with Tim Howes, which I'm actually very excited for, because the chats that excite me the most really are the ones where I am almost quite ignorant, where I've sort of read one or two things and I don't really know the person, the actual thinker we're talking about, you know, outside of a couple of books that well, and then you end up getting these sort of, you end up actually getting the real basic answers, which is what I'm always after, the very accessible basic answers, but you also get the nuggets of wisdom and the small little bits that the other person knows, so it's always a great way to have a conversation. Someone asks, would I make more Bernhard novel reviews? So since doing those two Bernhard reviews, I've since read about another 8 Bernhard books, and actually, every year, my mum always asks, you know, what do you want for your birthday? And every year it's books. And this year it's 4 Bernhard books. So I may do a review of one of those. The problem with reviewing Bernhard is it would probably take quite a while because there's so much... It seems like it's all the same. I mean, it seems, in a pragmatic sense, each Bernhard book, barring a couple, is an outraged Bernhard, you know, pseudo-biographically inserted into the book, going on a rant for 200 to 300 pages in his beautiful flow and prose. But there is so much nuance between the books that it may very well be worth. I think if I was to do a review on one, I would probably try to do a really lengthy review, really digging into Bernhard, and it would be on the Lime Works, which thus far was the best one, I think, and one of his most accomplished ones, even though it was only his third. Someone else asked a question there. I won't read out the question. When was the last time? It's quite a while ago. Someone said, I really enjoyed listening to your interview with Kevin Carson a while back. Do you still have any interest in him or C4SS types in general? I think, so with Kevin Carson, my memory was, someone asked me to do it, and I did get an interest in Kevin Carson at the time. And he's extremely encyclopedic, like this huge book, encyclopedic writer with all this data, and outside of that, the Center for a Stateless Society, this sort of, I don't know as much about C4SS It was mainly someone asked about Kevin Carson, and I read his work and I was interested. I still have an interest in anarchism and stateless ideals, though, I mean, it's something that I guess to talk about in terms of before I had a fair amount of libertarian sympathies. And I think over time now, I've just come to realize from conversations with many close friends that something like a state always aggrandizes, and you really can't avoid that. And something like something, even though you could say, well, the authority is a private corporation or a private consumer choice that is completely within your free agency, I'd probably disagree with that. In a very, very practical, pragmatic sense, sure, it's your own choice. But at the end of the day, the authority of a libertarian society is whoever's the best at advertising, whoever's the most convincing at advertising, or whatever the private means might be. And actually reading Zizek's First as Tragedy, then as Farce, to paraphrase a small section from that, a very, very rough paraphrase, but he basically says, like, you know, if, and this isn't, I mean, from him, of course, it is going to be a somewhat Marxist ideal, not I fully agree there, but his, I'll try and get this out. His point is, if the end result, if the end result of capitalism is what we've got, which is just people buying masses and masses of, you know, crap and things being used unproductively, though libertarian types would like to argue, you know, well, who are you to say what it is to be productive? If the end result is that, then I'm not all that interested in it, you know? So, but that doesn't really mean you have to go full bore the other direction. So I don't know, but the just sort of centering the conversation around C4SS and Kevin Carson and stateless and anarchism and these kind of things, I still have a great sympathy for it, but I can't help but see that something like an authority and something like a state always will always return. There's always at least be some abstraction of centralization, because it's just that's just the way things are and will be, especially with systems like the internet and, you know, the so-called global village, which seem to spontaneously centralize things in that way. And it, you know, we can see this from things like cryptocurrencies, etc., that decentralization takes, you know, what someone like Gurdjieff would call a super effort. You know, it seems like the natural inclination is to centralize, and that any of these exits and fragmentations, which of course, you know, exit and escape and all that, I'm all for it, but it takes this extra effort on top of the normal, which is very, very difficult to achieve. Thoughts on Nikolai Berdyaev? I might as well just say I know the name. I know another one of those ones where I know the name. No thoughts there. Someone says, I know you're heavily continental oriented, but do you have any interest in analytic philosophy? So I have an interest in it. I have a compendium. A great thing about analytic philosophy is you can actually get pretty much the whole history of analytic philosophy in a compendium, because they loved papers, you know, X equals blah, blah, blah. Here's the thing. I do have an interest in analytic philosophy, but it's no way near as enjoyable as far as I've found, as natural to sort of talk about in terms of a conversation, you know, when you're getting into the nitty gritty of like Russell and set theory or what Elfrege and language and what, you know, what that all means. It's just not as enjoyable as something that is perhaps has a leaning more towards the subjective or whatever that might be. So I have an interest. I mean, I tried to get an interview on that unsung hero of analytic philosophy. I can't remember his name. He died very young, and there was a biography written about him. I would like to do more episodes on analytic philosophy. It's just how to approach it in the format that I do. I mean, I don't, you know, I wouldn't know as well how to approach it. Bunny 2, happy birthday, James. I want to thank you for the talk. I remember you. It was a great talk. Lots of anti-Oedipus, and I remember you actually explaining the body without organs. It's probably the only time it's ever happened. So I do remember you. Thanks very much. Hey, James, thanks for the content you've been getting me through mind-numbing work days for years. Do you have plans for a follow-up for your Kabbalah 101 episodes? I think I do, even though it's been quite a while now. I've been reading more and more Kabbalah stuff. The difference is that the first Kabbalah episode where I was outlining just the structure of the Tree of Life is fairly straightforward across the board for all types and most correspondent systems. You might just switch some names. I don't know, the Lima might put iOS in where... someone else would put some other god, and then Fortune would put Christ or whoever, and you can get that basic structure and then sort of move the basics around. But the three pillar structure with the 10 Sephiroth, you know, generally stays. When you get to paths, you get to books like 777 by Crowley or other books about correspondences, there's so many different correspondences within one path and that one meaning that I just felt when I started to outline it, I was like, this is just almost neat, like so much detail. And it was also getting into the area where I'm not too keen on talking about it, not because I think there's anything wrong with talking about it, but when it's getting to the area of like, that experience is going to be someone else, like it's going to be your own experience doing it, so maybe I should have just kept that to one. But I may touch on that more with Greer, and then after that see if I can figure out how to do that episode well. Inkalor says, if you had to add something to exiting modernity, what would it be? That's a fairly good question, to be honest. I don't think about think on exiting modernity too much. I think I would probably add, I would honestly add a chapter about being pragmatic and trying to foresee and see, because we don't normally see this, what actual abstractions we like or we value. What abstractions does one personally value? What I mean by that is, I think a lot of people don't realize. I mean, I know I didn't for a long time, and then you notice it's something that happens a lot. I didn't know for a long time that actually the thing that I valued beneath a lot of my decisions was stability. So being able to see that, and then from that understanding that exit is nice and everything, and doing these kind of things is really nice, and I am in a position of sort of privilege to be able to do what I do. But at the same time, there is something to be said for understanding that that it, you know, the modern world is here to stay for a while. I mean, you know, I have all my sympathies for collapse, but I also have my sympathies for AI. To be honest with you, I think it's going to be a mixture of both in the future. And I also have I also read Spengler and agree with Spengler on a lot of things. And in that sense, for people who are about my age, which is going to be 30 next week, I would probably foresee that as long as you're fairly sensible with your income and things like that, and you don't overstretch your means and want to do all these super duper fancy things all the time, the rest of your life is going to be roughly the same in terms of society, culture, collapse, if you want to call it that, and maybe not so much AI, that might honestly accelerate fairly quick. But so then the question becomes, well, what if things aren't going to change all that much on some sort of fundamental societal collapse based level for the next probably 100 years, then, you know, then where do you go from there? And then, you know, modernity is here to stay for a while. So the end of exiting modernity will probably be something akin to what happens when nations start to fall, which is, okay, we don't really like modernity. It's clearly very corrosive in terms of whatever that abstract ideology is. But that's not to say you can't take from it what you need to get by, right? You still have to live within it. You still have to live close by. It's one of the points of the book. I guess it would just be reiterating the point of the book is, any exit where you just shoot off and ostracize yourself, it's not the best way to do things. Happy birthday, James. Do you think gnomes are real? They probably are. I did have a book where I could contact the king of the gnomes, but I never did it. Are you interested in the recent work Q accelerationism? So I wrote a piece on Q accelerationism actually in relation to Spengler. So that's the Cute Act book by Amy Ireland and Maya B. Chronic, recently from Urbanomic. The point of my piece was that I basically thought that actually they had given in a really great way, though this isn't actually what I say in my piece, because I relate it to Spengler and this, like, once again, actually back to that, the transition between the stages and what to do, like what to do when you realize you are of a certain epoch, or, you know, this is like the Nietzschean decision between active and passive nihilism. And I think Cute Accelerationism was really like a, I hate the word manifesto, and I'm sure they wouldn't like me using it as well, but I'll use it, like a manifesto of active nihilism in a way. You know, it was a real call of how to be and what is going to be in the future to come. And, you know, yeah, and what then the main thing I really enjoyed about it was it was a serious work that didn't take itself too seriously and certainly didn't boss you around. And even like, it made me realise that even something like Anti-Oedipus has this bossiness of beneath everything. It's still that dialogue of like, well, I'm writing this because it is correct, it is right. Yeah. Have I read Gershom Scholem's Major Trends? I tried to read Scholem's Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism, and I remember not being able to get very far into it, and that was quite a while ago, so I could retry and see. Again, same person. What's the best advice you'd give for someone in their early 20s based on my experience? Early 20s. So a lot of people, so many times people used to ask me, what's your advice for doing, you know, studying philosophy or doing a degree, right? So my advice for people in their early 20s is, you know, I'm not anti-academia, I'm not anti-university, I'm not anti-degrees, but, and it's once again back to a sort of a pragmatism. People can talk all day about whether or not there should or should not be more funding for certain things. But as far as the future's looking, there is going to be just less and less funding for academia and for universities. There just is. I mean, it's already on the downward slope. So I would just say, no, it's not. I'm not going to say don't. But I would say that if you intend on taking an arts degree, be entirely sure, 99% sure, that you have you see at least some path that you're truly interested in. You know, do an art degree if you want to become an art teacher or become an artist. Take a philosophy degree if you want to become a philosophy teacher, etc., etc. So, you know, with that said, I've like turned. There's been like two or three different times in my life where I've turned it around within the space of 6 months, you know. So when it's like, oh, early 20s, and you can get this panic, especially in our culture of comparison, you can turn things around very, very quickly, like within 5 or 6 months if you really want to and you really want to change. I mean, you have the internet and you can learn pretty much anything you want very quickly from some of the best teachers there are. So I'm trying to think of things. I mean, you know, I wish I hadn't drunk as much. I wish I'd been more honest about what actually interests me, even if it was very weird or just like kind of autistic, to be honest. Other things for early 20s. I mean, don't worry about living a boring life for now, because it probably will pay dividends down the line. And one thing as well, I think even for even younger age, but early 20s is probably the latest time to admit it, is be fine to admit that there isn't anything you really want to do within the normal scope of things. It's a big struggle for me when I was in school. It was a constant, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to be? And I never had an answer. And still to this day, I don't, you know, I was never going to say I'm going to be a philosophy podcaster. So, you know, there is just this thing of like, you might just have to try find what you want to be. That sounds very ridiculous, but there you go. Happy birthday. Any chance of having Brian Monihan on author? It's Thomas Monihan, I think, or Monihan. But anyway, I was in contact with him a while back, and as with some guests, it's probably my fault. It just I lost track of it, and we didn't get around to doing it, so I could recontact him and chat about spinal catastrophism, which is something I want to get around to reading. Hello, I really liked your talk with James Maffey. It's one of my favourites. One of the favourites I've done on the podcast is with Jim Maffey. He's a great guy. We spoke for a little while afterwards. He's a really, really friendly guy to chat to, and I greatly enjoyed it. Any other readings you'd recommend on Indigenous American thought? Also, will you be speaking about any more works regarding mad studies? So one thing on the Jim Maffey is he's done this talk on the Tonalmat. I probably mispronounced that. So, which is Mexico, the ethics of Mexican philosophy and this kind of thing. So we're going to be talking about that. So hopefully going to be talking about it with him again. As for more Indigenous American thought, I'm planning, as though it's been in the works for about a year now, because I do admittedly find her work quite difficult to read, is Leslie Marmon Silko, the author who writes about that kind of thing, with Nick Monk, who recorded the episode about Cormac McCarthy. Will I be speaking any more works regarding mad studies? Both of the guests who came on to chat about mad studies, I'd love to talk to again. So hopefully, yeah. Have I done a DNA test? If yes, what are you? 100% British, mate. I've never done one. I don't have that much interest in it. As far as I'm aware, Ellis is actually French. So this doesn't mean I have any genetics from there. I don't know. As far as I'm aware, Ellis is actually is a French name. And most of my family are from up north. But also, as with a lot of people who are from Norfolk, so one side of my family is from Norfolk, extremely old part of Britain. So it could just be that I'm 120% English. Who is this? Who is the cutest patootie I know? You know who it is. Do you think that Chiron is different from other pessimists? These words, pessimism, nihilism, antinatalism, they all get so mixed up. I think Chiron is different because it's not really philosophy, to be honest. Some of it gets close, but it's largely prose and aphoristic works. Sometimes it's closer to poetry. But I also find it's lived with Chiron. Completely lived. Not a word of it isn't lived. And he... I find a lot of hope in Chiron. And I still have yet to struggle with him. I'm still yet to really, you know, pin him down. There's a lot there to read. I mean, you know, so in the sense that he's a pessimist. He definitely is, but he's a tough one to crack. I haven't read much Chiron in a while because Bernhard has become my new Chiron, so yeah. As for what I'm doing for my birthday, I'm going out for a meal, by the way. Any advice on reading, like reading methods or anything like that? I think when it comes to non-fiction, I'm not big on speed reading, but when it comes to non-fiction, I don't really mind it, especially with a lot of the sort of modern 350-page books where you feel like really it's mostly filler. But in terms of just in terms of advice on reading, just make sure you put the time aside every day. And I think one thing that I've spoken about with friends recently is to be reading kind of constantly. That sounds ridiculous, like not literally, but to just, even if you know, you're like, you have 15 minutes or something, just sit down and just, that's how you get through books, and just always, like, always be reading, basically. And that's the way you get through things. And you, for me, that's the way I've really learned to read. I don't so much anymore sit down, really dig into a book as I used to. It's the pre-30-year-old game to do that and take notes and all that. Yeah. Other than that, I don't have too much advice. Do you have any thoughts on psychogeography? I've heard the term and I couldn't tell you too much about it, so I'm going to look it up and we'll see what's going on. Annual grass touching, someone says. Geographical location on the emotions and behaviour of individuals. Okay. You know, it's interesting. In one of Bernhard's books, he writes about Salzburg, Austria, about, you know, because it has, I believe Austria has the highest suicide rate, and then Salzburg of any city ever has the highest suicide rate, right? So it's like this question of why does this, you know, Bernhard is sort of half jokingly riffing on this idea of why, you know, why here and what is it to live in such a place. In terms of this, I've never read anything like specific books about psychogeography, so I may be getting the meaning wrong here, but I think it's definitely true. I mean, I've got a collection of short stories coming out hopefully by next month that really are all based in Norfolk towns, even though none of the towns are named. And just living in Norfolk has given me a very Lynchian, peculiar, you know, outlook on very empty sort of Resident Evil feeling outlook on things that you don't get elsewhere. And I mean, you know, the idea of geographic location having a psychological effect on people. I mean, just go to Leeds, you know, and go to Birmingham, right? what's my favourite food? Oh man, what isn't? My favorite dish is pasta aglio e olio, which is pasta, garlic and oil with parmesan and parsley on top. I mean, it's ridiculously bad for you because it's like a cup of olive oil. But anything, it's one thing with a self-diagnosis of autism. One thing I didn't realize is that one autistic trait is that you enjoy extremes of flavors. So if I eat like a basic bolognese, I sort of just taste a general savoury flavour, you know, I don't get anything amazing. So I tend to oversalt all my food. So like my favourite flavours are like, you know, a grapefruit or citrus, or, you know, if the recipe calls for one clove of garlic, I'll put in like a whole head or whatever. So those kind of flavours, intense flavours like sour sweets and all that kind of thing. Those are my favourite kind of foods. Anything that is going to give you acid reflux, basically. What have I learned from Bernhard? That is a good question. He's real just companion, but he's a companion that holds you at arm's length. So you read him and then just go off, but there's just something about the flow. I mean, in terms of learning, you know, especially as a writer, like, it was more like, so I guess, kind of revelatory of like, you can just, you know, complete overthrow of the rules. I mean, you describe, like I've said to people before, you describe a Bernhard book and it just shouldn't work. I mean, it's no paragraph breaks, a guy talking about the same, like literally the same thing. If you read The Cheap Eaters, it's the most repetitive book I've ever read for about 130 pages. And miserable and annoyed and bitter and sarcastic the whole time. And yet somehow it works. And, you know, that's a testament to his rhythm, to his brilliance. Someone says, forgive me if I'm mistaken, but I think I remember you mentioning you worked in finance for a bit. How did you transition from that into philosophy? So during one of the crypto bull runs, I just worked for myself again, doing trading, but eventually that whole thing bottomed out. And that was when I was studying my master's in philosophy. So I pretty much did art from school and then art in college and then did a fine art degree and then moved from the fine art degree fine art degree into a continental philosophy master's. While I was doing that, I was doing the finance stuff. And then after that, I went into marketing. And then, you know, and then on and on and on. And I was briefly studying a master's degree in economics at Mises, but once again, the cost of living stuff just made it impossible to continue. And now I believe they've actually shut down their master's because they were struggling for funding as well. Any familiarity with effective accelerationism, Guillaume Verdon, based Bastille? So, with regard to EAC, I recorded an episode with Mark Andreessen on accelerationism and AI that might interest you. And we mentioned effective accelerationism. General thoughts on Silicon Valley optimist types adopting land. I mean, I think for me, just from being in the sphere of accelerationism for a long time, what I see them adopting is sort of a mutated form of left accelerationism. So it's not so much that the AI is going to accelerate, the technology is going to accelerate for, in a Marxist sense, then be able to be utilized specifically for the rise of the proletariat. And the emancipation of the proletariat, but it's more that, like, I think for the EAC types, the emancipation is just a side effect of something much, much larger. But that's where I draw the line, is the chatting about with people about this just last night, actually. That's where I draw the line, is just before, I don't agree that, I don't really understand what singularity could even be, you know, this idea of AI becoming a consciousness or whatever that might be. But before that, the notion of, for me, I think the limit we will get to with AI is human beings for maybe 50 to 100 years become redundant, and then eventually, you know, things will go wrong like they always do. But I don't know, you know, I haven't really kept up with it since then. So, yeah. Oh, and my other favourite food, which is, I have to sort of slow down now, I'm 30 because I get fat, is sweets. I like love sweets. And actually, one of the things I got myself for my birthday is a kilo bag of Bubs, which is like a Swedish jelly sweet. They're great. What do I think about Trackle? The only real time I've, in any real sense, read Trackle is via Land's dissertation, the cultivation of the grapheme, which is to do with Heidegger mostly and Trackle. Outside of that, I haven't. These poets and writers that Heidegger et al. Refer to, Hölderlin being another one, Rimbaud is another one, I never got around to them specifically. And Rimbaud is someone I keep meaning to get around to. So, we'll see. Schlegel is another one, I think, that they constantly refer to. Yeah. And if, you know, other than the questions, if there's anyone you'd like me to do an episode about, just bung it in the chat and I'll make a note of it. I think the next book review is going to be, by the way, The Third Reich by Roberto Bolaño. I managed to get, you can get this really nice slipcase hardcover edition for about $2. I'm looking forward to that. That's probably going to be the next review, because there's a fair amount of something there for me to dig into. Someone says, I've been reading too much analytic philosophy for a graduate course. Can you recommend any anti-analytic philosophers to annoy my professor with? Right, so what... The continental analytics divide in one context makes sense, in a stylistic context makes sense, but in a methodological context it doesn't. I mean, you know, Husserl, for instance, is emphatically on the continental side of things, but he is doing much the same sort of work as many analytic philosophers when you really look at it. So anti-analytic. I mean, it'd probably be like someone like Derrida, I guess. You know, like Derrida would be the best to go with, I'd say. But there's, I mean, ironically, maybe Wittgenstein. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I need to know analytic philosophy a bit better before I can, before I can criticize it. Which is your favorite episode of Young Sheldon? The one where it ends. A podcast on Kylo Michelstädter. I have. I think you referenced that person, him last time, and I have something bookmarked, which I did email the person, and they never got back to me, which is common. It's not, you know. But I can't remember who it was. There was a couple of Kylo Michelstädter books on Amazon, which is usually like how I find most things, because I just can't find them via academic publishers. The Wreckage of Philosophy by Mimmo Kangani, or I think was who I emailed and didn't get a reply back. Any chance of another land interview? I don't know if anyone knows where land is at the moment. We tried to record one like years ago now, and it was around Christmas time. It was meant to be on horror, and all we recorded was like one sentence when I asked Nick if he enjoyed Christmas, and he said he did, and then the connection cut out. I still have that clip somewhere. And at one point, and Greer was completely up for this, but then Nick never replied. At one point, because John Michael Greer and Land are born in the same year, and they've sort of, you know, gone on separate paths. So I wanted to organise, you know, the great bearded druid and the shaven singularity, right? And then have them. Chat away and talk about it, but I don't think Nick never replied, so maybe I'll retry when Nick gets back to Twitter or whatever. An esoteric Dune review for clicks. So I liked the film, I liked the first part of Dune, even though at times it was a little bit flat, but I'm not keen on the book. I've never made it through the book. I've read the first third about three times, and then I just dip out. I just find it kind of dull, to be honest. It's one of those greats that you just think, okay, I'm just don't get it. I mean, the ultimate book of greatness that I don't think is very good at all is Siddhartha. I just that Nightwood by Juno Barnes, but Siddhartha, I just was like, this is just terrible. This is the most boring thing I've ever read. So I like the idea of Dune. I like this world, but where I can read about Junger and Chiron relation. I don't know if I've, outside of like small articles and posts, I don't know if I've read any extensive treatment of that, at least not in English. There probably is, I imagine there definitely is in the Junger collected works, which is huge. But I haven't read anything in English. One of the things I know about that was that Chiron, I think it was this way around, Chiron tried to get Junger into certain authors and he just wasn't that interested. But the one picture of them together, they've clearly had a few beverages. Movie reviews is kind of tempting, but it's not as, I wouldn't have the thing there with me to talk about. So I'd have, and also one of the things about like doing a review of something is you you do have to consume it differently. You have to take notes as you go along, think about how you might talk about it, how you, you know, what's important. And it doesn't necessarily spoil it, but it changes the experience of it. So yeah. But yeah, if there's any other questions or anything else that people would like to see from the podcast, yeah, please let me know. I'm trying to think of anything else that's coming up. How do I reconcile my occult views with my pessimism? Well, I think that's a stretch, but I think to say that all spirituality is inherently optimistic would be wrong. I think there's a lot of pessimism in spirituality. I don't think they need to be reconciled. You can be a believer who's pessimistic and about the world, at least. There has been a Jack Parsons episode with the author of Strange Angel, the book. Though I do think the series is pretty good, to be fair. Happy birthday. Thanks for your work. Thank you very much. I'll be 30. 30. They say that your 30s are your best years. Do more episodes with Tom McGowan. Your conversations with him are always so interesting. So many people say that my chats with Todd are their favourites. And I'd love to. But, I don't want to keep bothering Todd. You know, that's the thing. So I do it when he has new books. It's the easiest way. But, no, I always have a lot of fun with McGowan. He's a great guy. Can you get the Spengler guy back on for a What To Do episode? David Engels, the Spengler guest, he's also, I'm not sure if he'd consider himself a Tolkien scholar. I think last time we spoke, he said, you know, he just has an extremely deep interest in Tolkien and reads Tolkien every day. I may contact him soon about possibility for a Tolkien episode, maybe a Tolkien episode from a Spenglerian point of view, because The Lord of the Rings is an extremely, maybe not extremely, but it's a very, very Spenglerian book. You know, you can see the cycles that have already died. You're in this sort of cyclic history of different apocalypses and different eras. So I may contact him very soon about that. Do I still consider myself a believing Catholic? At the start of this, I was talking about my spiritual journey, and there's a book coming out that I wrote for Aeon, Spiritual Introduction to Christianity, really focusing on the spiritual path of Christianity, which is what I found lacking. And the problem, this notion of like, do you still consider yourself X? Do you still consider yourself a Catholic as if everywhere you go, Catholicism is exactly the same? And it's one of the big problems is that Catholicism is way more decentralized than people think. I mean, it's not. It doesn't, on a day-to-day basis, has pretty much nothing to do with the Pope, as far as my experience went. It's going to differ from parish to parish, from priest to priest. So it is a difficult thing to really get into. But in terms of the believing, I mean, that's a struggle. It comes and goes, and it's up and down, and I integrate it with other things that other things and experiences that I have of of life. I know that sounds like a bit of a cop out, but it's a journey. It goes forward and it's tough and has its ups and downs. Have I considered an episode with or on John Crowley? Is he? I think I know who that is. Is he the guy who wrote? Yeah, he wrote Little Big. I quite enjoyed Little Big, but I don't know if I fully got it. It was a while back because I know that Little Big is Rand Prieur's favorite book. That's one of the reasons I got it. Is Rand had a list of books that he really enjoyed, and Little Big was on there, and it stood out. And it was, you know. But, yeah, maybe I'll contact him and look into that. But I'm just trying to think of other things that I've sort of... So one of the things is a lot of the authors that that I've become interested in. Like, so for instance, like Bologna, it'd be difficult to get a Roberto Bologna scholar because it's just so recent. I mean, with Bernhard, it was tough enough. Scholarship takes a while to sort of solidify, and even then it takes a long time to find. Academic publishers don't, you know, so much of it is very, very hidden away. It makes things tough. One I would like to see, I did email him a while back, but he has a new book coming out in June or July, would be Ray Kurzweil, just for the update of the AI. We've been talking about AI, but the AI singularity. Other than that, Yeah. Conversation with Parker. Set. Case. Let me have a look. I will bookmark that and look into it. If there's any more questions or comments or things like that, let me know. Did I receive a free copy, read Paul Bishop's book? I read the book, Discourses of Philology and Theology and Nietzsche, because, you know, we chatted about it. I received a digital copy. Sometimes I get sent physical copies, but it's usually a digital one. It's one of the problems with academic publishers is... it's library priced, you know, for libraries to buy, which doesn't make any sense to me, I know. It's not a comment on anyone, it's my own comment on things. But, it's the norm across academia, really, of just how they're priced. Usually, though, if you wait a year, a few months, 6 months or so, they release a paperback version. So it might just be a case of playing the waiting game. Confession time. Have I ever pirated PDFs? No. Have I considered doing an episode on with Federico? So I was meant to be doing an episode with Federico Campagna. And I... it was on... and I'd even sent off the questions. So it was on... hang on. It was on Prophetic Culture, his book that... so I think it had been about 2022. And he'd agreed to do it, and then I formulated the questions to then go fully organise the date, and he didn't get back to me. So I may hit that up and try to do it. What happened to Zapfer Part 2? Zapfer Part 2 fell through, and that was my fault, because... we'd agreed on this date to record, and then I was ill at the time, and then she went on holiday, and then by the time we'd come back, I had, you know, it was like different headspace. So yeah, it's unfortunate, but it's kind of my fault. But Campagna, I will look into again. John Crowley, I'll look into again. and then we'll see. I mean, I'd like to try do more on Zapfer. I don't know if on the Tragic, because I heard that on the Tragic had been translated and was ready to, close to being ready to launch. But yeah, if we could get the translator of that, then maybe it'll be another Zapfer episode. There's a lot more there in Zapfer to chat about, definitely. Well, oh, he seems to have disappeared from public view. Okay. Do I play any instruments? No. And I'm not, there's two things, not that I'm amazing at anything really, but there's two things in life that I just can't do, which is geography. Like knowing where things are on a map. I can read maps like for walking very well, but in terms of general geography, knowing where countries are, spatial location, you know, that I can't do. And the other one is like rhythm, and instruments are just, it doesn't work. So no, I don't play any. But yeah, unless there's any more questions, this has been good fun. And thanks for all your well wishes, and thanks for supporting. And yeah, thanks for all the support. Thanks for listening. Keep listening. There's always going to be more. And yeah, thanks for coming along. I'll give it a couple of minutes if anyone's got any more questions. Yeah, I've got Mindlander's translation. So the translator doesn't want to do an episode because I think he's just done with Mindlander, which is completely understandable. It's not really. So I've read about half of it. So it's volume one of The Philosophy of Redemption. And No, I don't think it's a very sort of talk-friendly philosophy in a way. Because it's fairly straightforward, and it's a bit sort. I don't know. It's almost dry. I'll think about it because people love the Mindlander content because there's not much out of it out there. I'd love and think also would be popular a 30-minute-ish vid on Land's theory. So one thing I would like to do in time is actually to do like a free, just not necessarily a course, but like a, I don't know, a 5 or 8 part intro to land taking. I'd start at some point outlining like the key essays in Fang Nui Mena, and then maybe one talk on Thirst for Annihilation and go through, and then end up at the theory of capitalism. Yeah, we'll see. But yeah, I'm going to go make my dinner. So thank you all very much for your questions and well wishes, and as always, thanks for the support.